Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Sydney Writers' Festival. You're listening to a podcast recorded live at the 2019 Festival.
Good afternoon, everyone. I've just sat heavily down on my microphone pack, so it's either going to be medically bad or bad for audio. So bear with me, if you can. Oh, yeah. Hi. Welcome to this Sydney Writers' Festival session. My name is Michael Williams. I'm the director of the Wheeler Centre in Melbourne, and I am thrilled to be here for this event today. I would like to kick off, as I always do, by acknowledging country. We're on the land of the Eora Nation, and I pay my respects to the Gadigal people, their elders, past and present, and the elders and members of their community and other communities who are with us today. I acknowledge country to acknowledge that the moral and legal implication of invasion remains unresolved to this day. It's also particularly appropriate to acknowledge country in this session because we will be talking about the nature of prison and incarceration. And in the past 10 years, the rate of Indigenous incarceration has increased by 45%. That's in the last 10 years. It's worth noting that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women, in particular, are 21 times more likely to be in custody than non-Indigenous women, and that's a source of great national shame. Rachel Kushner is astonishing. Is that too much? Do you want me to dial it back?
I just never know how to hold my face when I'm being talked about, but I'm deeply flattered. Continue.
If you want to stand behind the giant punctuation mark, you can do that because I'm going to say some more nice things. I'm sorry. I was confessing backstage that I think of all the gifts I've ever given, The Flamethrowers might be the book I've given the most times to people. It is one of my absolute favourites. I read it and it blew me away. That's applause for my gift giving. I hope you noted that. So that's nice. Or from the next theatre. I couldn't quite tell. The Flamethrowers is an absolutely astonishing book. I read it and immediately went out and got Telex from Cuba, which was Rachel's debut novel, and devoured that as well. Flamethrowers was a finalist for the National Book Award, as was Telex from Cuba. Her fiction's appeared in The New Yorker, Harper's, and The Paris Review. She's the recipient of a 2013 Guggenheim Fellowship and the 2016 Harold D. Vercel Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. And I couldn't have been more excited when her new novel hit the shelves this year. It is called The Mars Room. I've left my copy backstage, so I'm going to hold hers up just to make sure you know what it looks like. And it does not disappoint. It is absolutely astonishing. I'd ask you to join me in very rowdily welcoming Rachel Kushner.
Thanks. Thanks, Michael.
And to get the ball rolling, I asked Rachel to lie on the couch and let me psychoanalyze her, but when she said no, we settled instead on a reading from the book, which is a little more unorthodox, I think you'll agree.
What I said was I'd already told my joke, which is my analyst said, "Tell me everything." I did, and now he's doing my routine. It's a corny joke, but... So, all right. I have to wear these glasses because just in the last couple years, they shrunk all the text in all the books all over the world. So I don't know if you guys noticed. It's global. All right. Can you guys hear okay, despite the noise from the other bays? Okay. He would not call it loaded. How he felt when he got up, when he got on the plane. He was only starting to relax. He'd been on edge the whole time in Cancun. It was supposed to be a vacation, but minute by minute, he kept checking in with himself to find out if he was having fun, and he didn't know, and this made him anxious. So he took another Klonopin and lay down or got up or went to the bar or walked around on the sand, and it burned his feet, and he had to face down the fact that he was not a beachy type person and just wanted to get home and go to the Mars Room and see Vanessa put her body in his lap. It was the only way in the world he knew to get peace. Every person deserves peace. He meant whether anyone deserves anything is beside the point. He needed certain things to feel okay. Vanessa was among those things. He needed dark and heavy curtains because he had a sleeping problem. He needed Klonopin because he had a nerve problem. He needed OxyContin because he had a pain problem. He needed liquor because he had a drinking problem. Money because he had a living problem. And show him someone who doesn't need money. He needed this girl because he had a girl problem. Problem was maybe the wrong word. He had a focus. Her name was Vanessa. That was her stage name, but for him, it was her name because it was the one he got to know her by. Vanessa filled in around all the hazier thoughts in his mind with something that was specific and real. When he was near her, he felt good. Every person deserves to feel good, especially him, since he was himself. There was a couple next to him turned inward to each other like they didn't really want to talk, but he tried anyway. Sometimes shooting the breeze with people kills time on the plane. He told them about his boat, and he didn't actually have a boat, but he'd been talking for so long like he did have a boat that he basically, at this point, owned a boat. But they weren't interested, so he turned to the kid across the aisle, started telling him about his boat. Sometimes he thought of people as kid, called grown men kid, but this kid was a kid, Kurt realized. How old are you? He asked. 13. Nice. Kurt said it with a way to go, all right kind of tone. Kids, they like to be encouraged. He was rewarding this kid for being 13. 13 was puberty, old enough to get off. A woman came up the aisle and leaned over the kid. Kid got up from his seat. A man came up the aisle and sat where the kid had been. They were a family and they were switching. Nice knowing you, Kurt said. And the kid said, you too. No one would talk to him or rather listen. So he got his book out, Chicken Hawk, a Vietnam thing he'd been trying to read for 3 years. It interested him because he had begun long ago telling people he was in combat, but he never was. He was stationed in Germany. The book was about a helicopter pilot, and Kurt wasn't even halfway through. He read a few pages, but reading was difficult for him. The problem with reading was how relentless it was. You managed to concentrate long enough to read a whole paragraph, and then there was another one, and they just kept coming. He did it mainly as an act for the other people on the plane, except no one was watching him or noticing. He put Chicken Hawk away. He could not get his screen to work, so he closed his eyes and planned for when he'd be home and could go see Vanessa. Thanks.
I was really glad when you said you were going to read that passage, because it's very funny, and there is a lot in the book that is very funny, which is not what you necessarily expect from a book that's a blistering depiction of mass incarceration in the US. Like, your book is heartbreaking and tragic, but you delight in... I think Kurt's boat has a lot in common with many features through the book, which is people who are having to craft their own stories and build ways that they can present themselves to the world. Did individual stories come to you first, or did the stories and characters serve a kind of central idea?
It's a great question. Well, I would say both, depending on the character and the part of the process of writing the novel that I was at. That character, Kurt Kennedy, becomes fixated on the narrator, whose name is not Vanessa. As he says, it's her stage name. But since it's the one he got to know her by, he continues to insist on thinking of her by it as though she's formed a kind of contractual arrangement with him where she needs to continue to be Vanessa. Her name is Romy, and a lot of the novel is told from her perspective, and I had him in my mind as the person who is pursuing her and effectively stalking her. And I was pretty aware of what that feels like. Just being a woman and having a history, you just know how kind of scary and damaging and spooky and weird it is to have somebody just showing up left and right at all different places. But as I was writing the book, I experienced what seemed like a small epiphany about this guy, Kurt. And maybe it's obvious to all of you, but it wasn't to me until I had the thought, which was, he's not pursuing her to wreck her life and make her terrified. He's doing it because he's desperate to see her and believes that it's what he needs to function. You know, people develop their fixations not in order to be wreckages to other people, but in order to get through the day and survive. And so when I had that thought, I decided that it was really important to share his perspective on things. It was, you know, it was just about inhabiting him as somebody who's more complex than simply a villain. So that came later. And once I started to write him, I liked him. I thought he was funny, and he thinks and talks in a certain way that came easily to me. I mean, all the characters are always sort of like ventriloquized versions of the author, even though some authors maybe kind of don't admit as much, or maybe the reader thinks the author is like the character who fits their biographical description most tidily. But in fact, the author is all the characters. But there are other characters who came to me quite early, you know, before I wrote the book. There's a character named Conan, who is a trans man in the women's prison, and he's also very funny in a way that is familiar to me from people I knew growing up who were willing to challenge authority to entertain themselves and their friends, but at great cost to themselves. Like, Conan is sort of based on a friend of mine who was willing to insult a police officer after he'd been arrested and had his hands cuffed behind his back. And there was a kind of great spirit of vitality to that, and sacrifice and courage. And I knew when I decided to write this book that I wanted to have a character like that in the book.
I'm really interested in, inevitably, in a book about the prison system, the question of victims and perpetrators is going to be something of a preoccupation all the way through. And I'm interested in that journey to liking Kurt. Roma is clearly a character. She's a beautifully drawn character. As a reader, you care about her enormously by the end. And so it's hard not to resent characters who do terrible things or hurt one another, and you do an incredibly deft job at not letting anyone off the hook, not making the mistake, not mistaking empathy for romanticizing. Did you have to consciously do that? Would you find yourself sweetening it too much and then having to strip it straight back?
No. I think I'm just not wired that way. It's come up a lot since I wrote this book. The sort of moral calculus of it is such that people ask, you know, was it hard to... I have a character named Doc who was a former Los Angeles Police Department detective who murdered people on the job. He abused his power to kill people and ended up... He's like a contract killer also, and ended up with a sentence of life without possibility of parole. I don't know if you have that sentence in Australia, meaning like you will never go before a parole board and you're supposed to die inside the prison. And writing him, he was kind of, he wasn't based on a real person, but I encountered a real former cop from the LAPD who was serving a sentence of life without possibility of parole and was standing in his cell with him having a conversation, maybe just for 5 minutes, but he told me about people that he'd killed, that he had, they were killings that he had not been convicted of. And nobody else was around. It was just me and him in his cell, and I could see all of his kind of what personal effects he had, his little house plan, and he had a lizard in a box, and he had 2 photographs on the wall of Harley Davidson's, which obviously he doesn't own anymore. He's supposed to never leave prison. And I ended up writing a character because this guy's essence really went into me, like it went into my skin. And I have had people say, you know, well, was it? I think Doc is very funny, but he's not the most comfortable character for some people. And people would ask me, you know, was it hard to write him? Not at all. I mean, it was very easy for me to write him, but maybe I'm just not wired toward judgment, at least especially not as a writer, because once you've judged somebody or declared that they're either have taken the correct or the incorrect moral position, then what? How do you activate that person? How do you know what their thinking is? Because people rationalize in elegant and delicious ways, which isn't to say that they rationalize incorrectly or that I can see how they're rationalizing. Once you're inside the mind of a person, you see that they too want a positive self-image. But people get it in a whole host of different ways.
Do you think not being wired that way... Stop me if this is too personal a question and we'll get you lying on the couch. But is it...
Oh, it's just to go this way.
Are you not wired that way in life or only as a writer? Is it because when you're writing, you're serving the story or you're serving the work of art you're creating and so therefore there's no point in judgment because either it works for the story or it doesn't? Or is it more of a temperament thing, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, that's a really smart question, and it's a difficult one to answer, partly because the occasion of this book, I think, these things are always at play when you're writing a book, but this book in particular called for an explicit engagement with certain questions about lack of judgment, and also just what I've been doing with my life for the last several years. I became very interested in the criminal so-called justice system in California, where I live, and not in order to write a novel, but because it was a passage of life that I was moving through, and I got involved with a human rights organization that did work in the women's prison, and I was interested in the mechanics of the juridical process. I live near a huge criminal court complex in Los Angeles, and I became interested in several different cases that were moving through the courts. Now, the reason I mention this is, like, just for instance, there was a case that involved four teenagers who killed a guy in the process of robbing him. They were not assassins. They did not plan a murder, which is not at all to excuse what they did, but they killed this guy in the process of robbing him, and they all got life without possibility of parole. And this trial took 5 years to move through the courts. And by the end, I couldn't go anymore. It was too unbearably sad for me to watch this trial and just see all the fallout on all sides for everyone. But it was an occasion for me to think quite deeply, and sorry to get over personal, but about the kids that I grew up with, because the teenagers who were being tried did remind me of some people that I have known. And this thought occurred to me that, like I'd said before about everybody wanting a positive self-image, these kids who committed this robbery that resulted in the murder of the victim, they also want a positive self-image, but they were willing to be bold and get out of the car and use a baseball bat, you know? And like, I'm not excusing it, but inside of their realm and where they all grew up and all of their family members, older family members, as I learned through going through the trial, had been to prison. And none of them knew middle-class people who had pursued things like education. So you have to remember that you can't know what it's like to be other people, A, if you haven't had their background, but also B, I just had this thought that I remember from being young that I wanted to be respected by my peer group. And the people who were most respected when we were teenagers were the ones who were willing to destroy themselves to impress everybody else. And that's a very different childhood than somebody for whom respect can be garnered by, for instance, excelling at the violin or being on the debate team. And I'm not saying there's a parity between them, but I'm just trying to share how I have moved through these questions and thought about them myself.
No, I think it's really core to what plays out in the book. I read an interview with you where you described the book as in part being a book about childhood, and that being something that became more clear to you after you'd written it from the reception that you got from your friends for it. Can you expand on that a bit for us?
Yeah, I mean, my friends who read books and are, you know, but yeah, well, I have a friend from growing up who, she dropped out of ninth grade, which a lot of people did, so high school, but then later went back to school and became a juvenile defender for the city of San Francisco. So she has an office at this place called Youth Guidance Center that we used to call You Got Caught. It was YGC. And so go, and I, she let me go with her to, you know, to family court, to kids court. And we just spent so much time talking about our childhoods and the city of San Francisco now, where there are still kids in the system. It's a rich city because of the Silicon Valley money, but the vulnerable people in San Francisco are, you know, the lives of her clients are very extreme. In fact, much more extreme than the people that I knew growing up. But talking to her and thinking about childhood and putting some of the, I mean, some of our world is in the book as Romy's experience. And the reason that I did that is that the main character is from San Francisco and she's from my neighborhood. And I didn't want to do that at first. I'm not actually that interested in autobiography. There are writers who are, and I've not really been one of them. But for this specific story, to have a young woman who's heading into prison to serve two life sentences, I needed to have a real depth of understanding of who she was. And I know a lot of women in prison. I've engaged in dialogues with them. There's like multi-year-long friendships that I've built. But their lives are very singular to them and different than mine. And so it sort of like forced me back on myself, talking to them and seeing these differences. And so I utilized some of this background that's very familiar to me because I needed to have a character I could believe in who would be plausible. And to make her plausible, I had to mine some things from the past.
Did that process of reflection impede the writing process? Did you find yourself, you know, you talk about having middle class support or options that mean that you recognize the inherent privilege in not being trapped in that cycle. Did that make you feel self-conscious about being the one to tell these stories?
It didn't. I know. I guess I'm supposed to say that it did. But no, in fact, because I still go home and see my friends from San Francisco, and they were all really excited about the book. You know, there was a kind of, I don't know how to say it, but no, I mean, they're proud of me and encouraged me. And also, it takes a storyteller sometimes among the group, like a scribe, you know? And which isn't to say that the book is just a rendering from reality. It isn't. It's so many parts of it are fully imagined and meant to conjure the glint of truth from the world, but from the side of, you know, creative rendering rather than literal transcription. But no, I didn't feel that way. And in terms of like the dialogues that I have now with women who are in prison, they were extremely encouraging because the idea that somebody would want to write a book that could portray lives like the ones they live made them feel really validated. And so, which is, I don't want to congratulate myself. I mean, I kind of feel like the world's full of that right now, like people just being like, I'm the woke one or something, and I'm not into that at all. But in terms of like the people that I know in my small community in California, I felt like I was, doing something that other people, it would have value for them. And then I sent the book to everybody I know who's in prison, and people read it right away and were passing it around. And one friend of mine from prison wrote to me, and her one concern with the book was, she said, my fear with this book is that people who don't know anyone in prison and don't know what it's like here would read it and think you were making it up because it's too extreme to be believable to a middle-class person.
I'm very pleased and not surprised that you got that reaction from people to it. It is incredibly powerful in so many ways. I'm interested in the relationship between that, though, and the ways in which you are you don't romanticize the characters and you're pretty unflinching. I mean, it's not, you don't let anyone off the hook through the course of it. So it says a lot that they read that version of something that's familiar to them and they don't take it as a...
No falsely accused people, you know. I mean, that is just... I'm not saying it doesn't happen. It does happen, and it's an injustice when it does happen. But there's a temptation to focus on the person in prison who is more relatively innocent than the rest.
Yeah.
And that is to recreate the condition of possibility for prison. Because you're saying, well, there is a sector in society for the guilty people, but I'm saying this person's not one of them. You know, and I'm much more interested in the people who actually did some shit to get there.
They're guilty, but then what of it?
Say it again?
They're guilty, but what of it?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, then and you start to see, I mean, maybe this is more sociological, but when that many people are moving through the system, and most of them are poor people, the axis, like A-X-I-S, of innocence and guilt no longer really pertains, but I think it can be difficult to understand that. Like, it actually took me years to really understand that and why it's the case, because if people have a different set of conditions by which they're making choices, then the choices aren't really choices in the same sense that we think of freedom of choice, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense. Can I take you back for a tick to the point at which you started to become interested in the criminal justice system and
sure.
you got involved in a human rights organization? I'm just curious about, was that as a citizen of California who was seeing what was happening in your own state and wanted to understand it better, was there a particular trigger, do you remember, a case, or was there something that drove you to have heightened interest?
Not really, but I think it's a long-held interest because ever since I was a child, I felt sort of disturbed and unsettled by the idea that the state can step in and make decisions about your destiny and nobody can stop them from making those decisions. Even like people having to sign up for the draft to be conscripted hypothetically into the military in wartime, like that always really haunted me. And then we had a friend when I was a child, a family friend, who'd been in prison and he'd robbed a train. It's such an old-fashioned crime when I was little, and I was aware of that. And then in high school, a friend of mine from high school went to jail and then prison. And when he was in jail, he escaped from an exercise yard. And he ran to San Francisco from another town down in the South Bay. It's like 40 miles away. And that, the whole incident of it was very dramatic. And he went to one of my closest friend's house. And everybody, what would you do? They just got a whole bunch of beer and everybody had a good time. And the thing is, like, he just wanted to go home and be with his friends. But San Francisco called out like the paramilitary SWAT organization, and they descended on the roof and they had a helicopter and they were saying like, hands up, you know, and had these guns on him. And this is a guy who my character Conan is based on, who would make jokes and insult cops even while he was being arrested. And I wasn't there when this happened, but apparently he cracked open a beer and looked at them and said, man, you guys watch way too much TV, because the whole thing was so, you know, dramatically orchestrated. And that friend went to prison and became, as he put it, very good at prison. He became very good at prison. You know, he joined a prison gang and made his way up through the hierarchy. And then later he died. But it's, I think, seeing that transformation, I don't want to overemphasize it, but I think these things can mark you, you know? Like, they stay in there a little bit. And how somebody adapts to prison life and becomes, his name was John, he was very smart, very funny, and a kind of natural leader with a lot of charisma. And the way that he turned inward toward prison seemed to me like a decision that he made. I'm going to flourish here. I'm going to have this life. It was probably not that simple of a decision. It was probably gradual, you know, sort of more imperceptible transformation. And then once it's made, it's sort of too late to go back, because the kinds of skills that you acquire to be a badass in prison do not translate to life on the outside. In fact, they will harm your chances of staying out of prison. Mm. So maybe it could have been that. But also, just living in Los Angeles, it's a very intense city with a high poverty rate and the big sending counties. I'm always really chilled by that expression. They call certain counties big senders, meaning big senders to the state prison system. And all the state prisons are north of Los Angeles, deep in industrial farmland. And the big counties that send are Los Angeles, San Bernardino, and Riverside, which are all part of one metropolitan agglomeration. And it's, you know, a former industrial core where we had an aerospace industry and a steel industry and an automotive industry. And now 65% of people in California prisons come from those three counties, basically. They're urban people from urban centers who are now being sent hundreds of miles from home up deep into the middle of an almond orchard, in a cement box in an almond orchard. And that started to really interest me, because I lived near the courts and the jail, and I would see the sheriff's department buses and just feel this chill, like there's something going on. There's a whole structure of control here that isn't just brick and mortar prisons. It has all of these more invisible components to it. And once I started to see them, I felt like they were all around me and hard to unsee. Like, there was a while where it seemed like every guy who talked to me, that men don't talk to me that much, but the ones who did were all wearing an electronic ankle monitor. And you wouldn't know to look for such a thing until you understood how a certain class of men are being controlled in cities and in certain neighborhoods. It's the lump in the tube sock.
No, I'm fine. I thought I'd check. The State of California Tourism Board must have approached you and asked you to do some work for them. I mean, you're a pretty stirring advocate for that place.
I love California, and my book is partly about the beauty of California. So what a great turn.
The phrase man-made hell, I think, is in there somewhere. No, is that
a man-made hell on earth? Yes. Well, that is the character Gordon talking about industrial agriculture, but then he also says that the beauty there is what does he say, like it's an acquired taste. It's the beauty of the Central Valley is subtle, and it requires time. You have to spend time there to understand what to look for, because it's on a geometric grid, and it's a scale of farming that is so vast. It didn't start there as family farms that then were bought up by big corporations and became larger and larger. It began as corporate farming, and the farmers there were not even called farmers. They were called growers, and they were business people who didn't have a background in agriculture. But it's called a valley for a reason. It has a spine of mountains on both sides, the Sierra Nevada on one, and then the Gamelan mountain range on the other. And the writer John Steinbeck was from the Gamelan Mountains, from Salinas Valley, and wrote so beautifully about that area. And it's one of the things that people from the Central Valley who've read my book have said, I love that you included our relationship to the Sierra Nevada and the mountains, because people driving through on the highway don't know what kind of beauty and also just how heterogeneous the landscape can be there. I mean, I think California is amazing. We are the fifth largest economy in the world. I don't know if you know that. And Los Angeles is the manufacturing capital of the United States. So, I mean, we make underpants now instead of automobiles, but it's
also useful.
Say it again.
They're also useful, though. You need underpants.
Yeah, I mean, depending on your preference, personally. But
true.
No, useful. It's real life in California, I guess, is what I'm saying. And there's a lot of people, and in certain ways, I think of it as a place that can telegraph what I call the brutality of the near future. But then in other ways, it's the state that has everything and really should secede from the rest of the union.
See, that's, I teased you about it, and then you defended your state passionately.
Yeah,
you came in. But there is a sense in which you're so fueled by your observations of the injustice that you're writing about, and it's systemic, like it's integral to the way the state runs. Things are only possible if people are invisible or they're an underclass or they're not part of the kind of dominant discourse.
But there's no villain you can point to. So when you say injustice, I think, yes, but then again, yes, but there is, it's not like there were a group of people that decided, you know, let's be mean to poor people and people of color in California. It's much more complicated than that and has to do with the fact that there were droughts in California in the 70s and the land was devalued and farmers started selling to the government. And, you know, there are a lot of people in California, particularly in the Central Valley, who need work and are basically choosing between joining the military or working in a prison. So prison has become a kind of state-subsidized form of employment. I'm interested in understanding people and structures, which isn't to say that I don't have judgments about it. I think it would be much better if there were no prisons. But I don't write out of anger, really.
I'm going to back you up there. Much better if there were no prisons? You think prison doesn't work off the back of...
Well, I mean, I'm always a little hesitant to kind of veer hardcore into this kind of discussion when the context is fiction in my book. And the reason is that I don't want to over-associate my own ideas about the prison system with fiction, even if it's in there. Like, I never write out of a polemical place. When I was writing my book, I did not know what there should be or what there shouldn't be. And Or I walled off my opinions from the story at hand and the characters in the book because I wasn't using them to demonstrate a message that the reader should absorb. In fact, far from it. Instead, I was asking myself some rudimentary questions that I didn't even know I was going to ask. But if I go into a courtroom, I start seeing people's lives being destroyed day in and day out in this bureaucratic manner. I don't know the people, I don't understand the legal language, but I see what's happening. And then I would start to ask myself, what is the law? You know, and I want to come up with a really simple definition. The law is a set of rules that are meant to be equally applied to all people. And then you go, well, what do you do if people aren't equal? You know, so then you're in this, the great conflict between law and so-called freedom, which is a pretty cheesy word. But in this particular context means individual autonomy versus like a civil fabric that works, right? And then what is justice? The state does not offer anything like mercy. The stated objective of California in its prison system is what they call incapacitation. So they want to remove people from society to increase public safety. Their stated goal is not rehabilitation. So then I ask, like, well, what's justice? And then you turn to religion and see that, at least in the, like, Judeo-Christian, well, more Christian than the Judeo part, there's this concept called mercy. And then he's like, well, how would that ever apply in this realm? And so I was trying to ruminate on all these things while writing the book. After writing the book, I then spent 2 years working on a nonfiction piece for the New York Times about prison abolition, which is, it's not exactly technical, but it deals with all the different complex elements that resulted in prison building, and it's about a scholar and activist named Ruth Wilson Gilmore. And I consider that work a little bit separate, but the piece is about prison abolition, and I think abolitionists have a very interesting set of ideas about what the problem is and what to do about it, and they want to limit the scope and footprint of the criminal justice system by closing prisons and jails one facility at a time. And the less facilities there are, the less people will go to them. Because with California as an example, there's no limit to the number of people they will shuttle into the prison. If they build a new prison, they can fill it very easily. So if they stop building prisons, they stop putting people into them, basically. And there was a time before we even had prisons for women. So it's important to imagine a world in which we could function without them.
So there's the...
So this is where somebody goes, free bird! Sorry, I had to make that joke.
No. So there are the stories from your friends in your childhood, the stories you've come across. There's the sense of social justice and the interest in how it all works and how it fits together. At what point do those two converge and you realize you're writing a book rather than just living your curiosity about it?
Well, I mean, again, I think the social justice part of it is sort of not a conscious element for me of the book. It's more I want to observe and see the world and understand how it works and describe it and make a piece of art that has some glint of life in it. At a certain point, I knew I wanted to write this book. I wanted to write a book that takes place partly inside an institution, actually. I've always wanted to. My original idea was it didn't necessarily even need to be a prison. It could have been a different kind of institution, but the way that institutional logic works can be so absurd. You know, like I started going to prisons and I found they have a handbook that prisoners are supposed to read. This is actually in Texas, not California. And then they also give them a guide to the handbook. And the handbook is 100 pages long and the guide to the handbook is 140 pages long. So then I have a character go, you know, are we getting a guide to the handbook? Because that's the way prison works. But so I guess I always kind of knew I was writing a book.
In an interview, I read you resist. The interviewer asked you about how you research your material, and you weren't thrilled by either the word material or the word research in that question.
Yeah.
But you are someone who, you know, you went and spent a lot of time effectively undercover in prisons. You, by anyone else's definition, you would appear to be a person who does a lot of research for your book. So what is it about the idea of research that doesn't sit right with you?
Yeah, I really don't feel like I do research. I mean, I keep saying this in interviews, and then I had a Polish interview who goes, I know you don't like to talk about research. And then he was like, wink, wink, as though I'm just doing this thing that I need to not say the word that is the name for the thing I'm doing as I do it. But like, my first novel was researched because I want to understand what happened and the role that the Americans played in the years leading up to the Cuban Revolution, the American expatriates who lived there, of which my mother's family were one. And it's a time and a place in which I did not exist myself. I spent a lot of time in Cuba in order to write about it and understand it and read like, you know, 100 books or something and then synthesized it all and then tried to imagine a novel. But since then, I've never done anything like that again. And The Flamethrowers was a gift to myself in the sense of writing about things that I had acquired naturally through the organic process of life. And so it was really fun for me, you know, because I know about motorcycles. I used to ride Italian motorcycles, and I write about art, and I know a lot of people in Italy who are involved in radical politics. And it was like, how can all these things, how are they going to fit together? Or rather, I just start writing and then I realize, oh, I need this here and this is something I happen to really know about. With this book, it was more like, as I said, at a certain point, I decided I wanted to learn everything I could about the criminal justice system. And that was as a Californian and a person living in Los Angeles who's interested in the world around her, which I think is a pretty normal thing and not a sort of like niche thing, you know, to find out about things. Contemporary reality to me includes the question of carceral control and jails and prisons and court. And like I was describing, once you see it, it's really hard to unsee. So then you go to write a novel and the novel is sort of there. But I was also curious about the interior spaces of prison that are off limits to the middle class person. Like you walk into a courtroom and it's a theatrical open thing. Anyone can go and watch a court proceeding. Once somebody is convicted, they go to state prison and they are never seen again. And I got invited to go on a tour, but couldn't say I was a writer. And we got to walk around on prison yard. So I guess you could call that research, but I would have done it whether I was writing a book about it or not, because it was an incredible opportunity. I mean, maybe I'll finish it up with this. John Cheever wrote this really great book called Falconer that a lot of it takes place in a prison. And he taught at Sing Sing Prison in New York. And I do a lot of mentoring and work in prisons in California. He was asked the same question I get asked about his research. And did you teach at Sing Sing in order to write Falconer? And he said, I didn't teach at Sing Sing to write about prison, just as I didn't get married to write about women. And it's well put, I think.
I love it. I also feel like you overestimate the level of active curiosity and diligence of your fellow citizens. I think there is something remarkable about the generosity of empathy that requires not just being curious about something, but following that curiosity and doing something with it. There is an opportunity for you to ask questions of Rachel. A couple of microphones are doing the rounds. Put your hand up and wave it around so that it can be connected with you, and we will get you this one up the front here. Oh, there's one there even closer.
I've actually got dozens of questions to ask you, but I'll try and stick to one.
Keep it to one.
In the Mars room, you seem to set up the expectation of a relationship developing between Romy and Gordon, but you don't deliver on it. Mm. And it seems to me that something quite similar happens in the Flamethrowers, in the sense that there's a possibility of a relationship developing between the unnamed narrator and Ronnie Fontaine. Could you just talk through your thinking about that? Why you didn't actually deliver on that, and what the thought process was in terms of constructing the novel?
That's a great question. I never thought about a parallel between those two people and that dynamic being common to them both. But I'm sure you're right. Well, with the Mars Room and that relationship, Gordon, for people who haven't read the book, is a teacher in the prison. And he's a little bit naive about the power that he has over the women in the people in his class because of the fact that they're not free and he is. And he develops a bit of an infatuation with Romy that is different than the infatuation that Kurt Kennedy, whose part I read a small part of a longer thing in the book about him. But it's different than that, but it's... if you're a free person and you're fixated on someone in prison, it's important to remember that that person may have no resources and no one to call upon. So the idea of a genuine relationship that is not structured by the power dynamic is just unrealistic. So I guess I was more interested in his infatuation with her and her desire to use him, which is a quite genuine desire on her part, if you will. And it's more about the misconnection between the two from each side than it is about people having a romance.
Is it... That was a lovely question because it involved a close reading, but I wonder how it feels to have readers who impose their own idea about where it's going, or the language around not delivering seems really interesting to me, that readers invest and they bring their own stuff into what they expect from a book. Do you find that part of the reception of your writing useful, interesting, challenging?
Like how people interpret things?
Yeah.
Well, I think his interpretation is very astute. So sometimes it's like, yeah, it's really cool. You write a book and then people are free to interpret it. It's theirs. And they're free to interpret it how they want. And they may see something in it that I never intended but is exactly right for the book. I mean, there are effects that a book can produce that are not intended by the author. But that doesn't mean that... that the reader's analysis isn't correct, you know? I always liked misconnections, too, romantically. Was that movie Happy Together by Wong Kar-wai? You guys know that film? Like, I love that movie because the two lovers really never connect. And so much of infatuation takes place inside one person's mind. You know, I mean, here we have the couch, and that's a Lacanian paradigm where, you know, fantasy is a fantasy of one. But it's two people each having it.
There is another question. Oh, there's one on the aisle here, maybe?
I'm going to give you two quick ones. You can answer either. I love the book. The Public Defender gets off really lightly. It's a passing moment of kind of failure and choice in a life. I'm interested in, given your friend and your interest in the criminal justice system, why the Public Defender and that part gets such a light pass in the story. And the other is, you're such an engaged person. How do you find creatively the time to write and still do the work you're doing in the community that is so powerful?
Oh, thanks. So when you say the Public Defender gets a light pass, do you mean that I was gentle on him?
No, I mean, you in the same way, there's structure and there's individual, and you kind of excuse the individual with the structure, and I think that's right for the story you're telling, but it's not a deep part of the narrative, and I'm interested in why that moment is not as...
Oh, I see. A light pass, like, meaning a kind of more surface treatment or something. Well, I don't know. I didn't really think of it that way. I mean, that the book is not so much about the public defender. These public defenders working in a place like California have an enormous caseload, so they don't have a whole lot of time to spend with each person. And her public defender does not do a good job for her. And I have friends who are public defenders who read the book in manuscript because I wanted them to vet, you know, the legal stuff and make sure that it was all correct and believable. And the one thing they said was, you're pretty hard on public defenders. And so I've thought about that, but I think what public defenders do is incredible, and a lot of them are actually the very top of their class in law school. They're the cream of the crop. They're people who are very, very smart, but the caseload that they get is unbelievable. And Romy's public defender, she says to him, you know, if I would have had money to hire a private lawyer, I wouldn't have ended up in this situation, but she's wrong about that, and he tells her she's wrong, and he says, you know, if you would have hired a private lawyer, the lawyer that you would have been able to afford to get would have been a joke. And you're much better off with the public defender's office, who can handle murder cases. They're used to capital cases, murder cases, special circumstances, murder cases. And the sad truth of it was that the circumstances of her case just didn't look good to a jury. And I've seen cases where the families hired a private attorney rather than a public defender, because, like, culturally it's considered, you know, like, they think that they're going to do better with a private attorney as opposed to the public handout, the public attorney. And the private attorney will be like a guy who normally handles drunk driving cases, and he's handling a murder case, or, he's doing, like, a juvenile is being processed and charged with murder in the adult system and has no experience with that. So I have great empathy for public defenders, but it's just one small part for her, because the guy is one small part of her life. Once your case is over, that person has moved on to other cases and is not really checking in on you much anymore. He does go to visit her, and that was partly because through talking to friends of mine, I said, if somebody got two life sentences, would that person stay in your mind? Would you continue to think about them? And everybody said yes. So I have him come back and see her, which some people do. And in terms of having time, I make time for things, I guess. I try to. I mean, people in prison don't take up a whole lot of my time, but if I even have a phone account where people can call me, collect, just to check in, have somebody to call, that's, you know, like 30 minutes out of my week feeling, they can only talk for 15 minutes and then the phone hangs up. And just doing that for people gives them a lot, to have somebody you can call in the outside world. So I do the calculus, and it doesn't really cost me a lot to give them something that means a lot to them. I mean, that's just one example. I do various things. But it's a better life to live a life you want to live, right? Engaged with people you want to be engaged with.
Thank you. I was very interested that you said you were able to send your book to people in prison, given that I think books are often quite constricted commodities in various countries, in prisons. And then on the other hand, prisons seem to be one of those places where letters still have great currency. And that's something that Tayari Jones talks a lot about in her book, The American Marriage. And so I wonder whether it's in terms of your fictional prison or the real ones, if you could comment on the role of words on the page in prisons.
Oh, that's an interesting question.
It's also, I'll just say, Kate Evans from Radio National, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. Excellent question, Kate.
Yeah. I mean, you know, books are of a premium in prison, especially for people who are doing time in administrative segregation, which is a fancy word or more bureaucratic word for solitary confinement, which they decided was torture, so they changed its name to administrative segregation. So, you know, people in cells that can't interact with the general population, reading is one of the ways that people get by. So I'd heard that the most popular book in the big women's prison in California is called Central California Women's Facility, and it's the largest women's prison in the world. And the most popular book there is by Danielle Steele, and it's called Malice, and it's about women in prison. And when I heard this from a friend of mine, I naively asked her, you know, wouldn't you want to read something else? And she really lectured me, but in a wonderfully gentle way. Like, you know, just because we live this life doesn't mean we don't want to read about people who also live like we do. And that book, she said, people were tearing it into pieces and sending them down the hall in administrative segregation. They use fishing line and they whip it out in the hall when the guard's not there. There are libraries in prisons. My book is banned by the California Department of Corrections now, meaning I wouldn't be able to donate copies of it to a library. And Simon & Schuster, my American publisher, wanted to donate not only my book, but their entire backlist of anything that the state wanted. And the state said no. So they didn't want Hemingway or Fitzgerald or all these great people that Scribner historically publishes. They are not interested in getting people books. They're more interested in limiting the access of outsiders to people in prison and to books. Before my book was banned, I did some readings in California prisons, which were so fun for me and thrilling and amazing. But it wasn't like I could get the book to people. I did a reading at a women's prison in Scotland, and the Scottish authorities had arranged for every woman who attended the reading to have a copy of The Mars Room before I got there. And they'd gotten it 3 days prior, and a lot of them had already read the book when I got there, which was incredible. But that's Scotland. That's different than California. But people do read, and I can get my book to people now just by sending it to them on Amazon. And, you know, there have been cases where it gets sent back, but most of the time they're not flipping through the book and looking to see if it's on a list of things that the libraries won't accept. You know, you can send paperbacks to people. There isn't as much of a culture of writing and books, I would say, in the women's prison as there is in the men's prison. And that's very complicated to get into culturally, why that is. There's more of a culture of learning in men's prisons, and I think that women's prisons are so psychologically terrorizing for the women that are there, and there's no privacy. There's 8 women in each room, 8 women to a cell, that it's hard for people to make psychological space to do something like read. But people do read, and I have a friend in prison. I just sent him, he's a trans man in the women's prison in California. I sent him The Lover by Marguerite Duras. And I said, I wonder if he'll find this book too weird. And he called me and said, oh my God, that book is so amazing. And then there was a whole list of people that were going to be borrowing it. And so it would be making the rounds. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Rachel will be signing copies of her books out there. They are readily available at the Glee Books bookshop. Please join me in thanking the extraordinary
Thank
Rachel
you, Michael. Christian. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to subscribe and rate our channel.